The one thing that pretty much everyone has in common is the need to have an accessible grocery store. In fact, what oftentimes distinguishes the socioeconomic makeup of a community is the quality of grocery stores that it has. The freshness, the variety, the options. But what happens when a grocery store no longer can serve its community because it just doesn't supply what residents seek out? We'll first hear a story of mine from a couple of months ago talking about an iconic local grocery store closing for business.
225 with a discount, 1780.
Customer Willa Sutton knows the store so well, she zips quickly up the aisles, picking up a few items from increasingly empty shelves. She shopped there 2 to 3 times a week since the store first opened.
Oh, yeah, I go to other stores, but this is a favorite one. Because I can always find what I need right here.
Pig's ears and pig's feet, for example, are among the delicacies that she could always find at Leon's.
I've always loved to come in here. I'm going to miss it very much.
Sutton will now have to get her groceries further away from the weathered Seven Oaks strip mall on East 39th Street where Leon's was located. Leon Stapleton, the store's owner, is 93. He says it was time to let it go.
It's part of my life right now, but we just can't make ends meet anymore.
Before opening his own grocery store, Stapleton had already been in the grocery business for 20 years. He says he was proud to be the first black person hired in Kansas City by Safeway 71 years ago. He opened his own store in 1968 on the heels of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Leon's son, Vernon Stapleton, says that wasn't coincidental.
After the riots, they allowed blacks to get SBA loans to get in business, where it probably wouldn't happen had Martin Luther King not got killed. So that was my father's opportunity, him and my mother, to get a loan to get this, and that's where it started.
Leon Stapleton believes his is the last black-owned grocery store in the country, and he has a theory on why so many have gone under.
You want me to tell you the truth? No support.
Vernon Stapleton agrees with his father. He'd taken over day-to-day operations of the store.
You got to have what everybody young from 25 to 45, that's the age group that you're targeting to be your customers. Older people love this store, but younger people want bigger, modern food, you know, and all the stuff that goes with in the 2000s.
The store was rented but not owned by the Stapleton family, and no updates had happened since 1980. It's an old-fashioned place with no fresh seafood or prepared food you can buy to just eat on the spot.
It's like from that 70s show or something. It needs to be redone, reimagined, whatever. A whole lot of re's in there.
Vernon Stapleton, now 62, says he worked in the store his entire life. Though he'll continue operating the liquor store next door, the closing of Leon's Thriftway is more personal.
My daddy had 7 kids, and all of us, this was our first job.
Even though Vernon acknowledges that Leon's Thriftway failed to provide options that newer stores have, he sees how the closing creates a hole in many other ways.
A lot of black people don't use banks for some reason. They would rather come pay a small fee for a check cashing service, pay their lights, gas, and water here. It's a one-stop shop.
Vernon Stapleton says Leon's Thriftway served as a general store, especially for those who didn't have cars. Beth Lowe Smith with the Greater KC Food Policy Coalition says that transportation piece is part of why the closing of this store is concerning.
The further from a store that one lives, the more challenging it can become to access it, particularly for people who don't have reliable transportation of their own.
Tony Ross says he's been coming to the store most of his life, and the closing is also about losing a community foothold.
We need to keep black business-owned stores in our own neighborhood.
Vernon Stapleton hopes he can find the capital to buy the whole strip mall and come back with a store that can compete with bigger, newer, more up-to-date stores.
I don't have any quit in me, and nor do my sisters, daughter, even my father.
That was a feature I did back in May, which inspired us to ask, what are people looking for from their grocery stores? I want to turn now to Rachel Jefferson, who's with me in the studio. She's the executive director of Historic Northeast Midtown Association in Kansas City, Kansas. And she's been seeing all kinds of talk and developments around grocery stores. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
So how important is access to a neighborhood grocery store for residents?
Well, I would say it's the number one concern for the residents with whom we work with in Northeast Kansas City, Kansas. Time and time again, they have expressed their concern and their want and desire for a grocery store in Northeast KCK. So it is probably their number one priority that still remains unmet.
Well, you know, it's I had no control over booking the show today, so it was just a coincidence that you happen to represent the area that I grew up in and that I live in now. So I can personally attest to the fact that it is hard to get any kind of groceries.
It absolutely is. I mean, the area itself, while it has such a rich and beautiful history and people that have stayed there despite disinvestment, despite white flight, it does still experience a lot of those same depressive factors that a lot of areas that are similar to it across the nation experience. And so I think while the food conversation has been going around for a while now, and people understand that, as Bethlow Smith said, transportation is a barrier. Nobody's really come up with a great solution for how to ameliorate those barriers and challenges.
You know, for those listening and you want to contribute to this conversation, how have you seen your local grocery stores change over the years? How important is having a grocery store near you? Call us at 816-235-2888. Be part of this conversation. I just think that it's just such a big deal, a bigger deal than people really talk about. I mean, there are so many divides in our society, but something as simple as being able to walk if you don't have a car, or drive within 5 minutes to go even get some toilet paper if you run out. I mean, what separates, in your opinion, a good grocery store from a bad one?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Well, in my opinion, a good grocery store is not only going to allow the community to have their material needs met, right? So their access to food, the commodities that you listed off before, but it'll also provide a gathering place for community members, a place where that kind of elevates social cohesion, where neighbors come to get to know each other, they commune and have different type of social interactions with each other and with the retailers at the store. And in that way, it helps to kind of build this connectivity that we don't see a lot in these neighborhoods anymore. And frankly, you know, because of disinvestment, but also because of the way we're living our lives, which are so fast paced and technologically driven. You know, we often are isolated from each other. And so the grocery store, in my mind, is a place where people come together to find some type of shared sense of community as well. And I think that's a piece of the conversation that often is left out when we're talking about the access, because we are, and rightfully so, so concerned with just people being able to eat, right? To not be experiencing food insecurity. But there's a lot of other tangential benefits to having a grocery store in the community, especially one that is owned by members in the community, like you were highlighting in your story.
Well, yeah, it's funny. That's one of the things I picked up going over to Leon's a few times, is that was a community store where people knew each other, where folks were joking around with the folks who run the store because they come in all the time. I mean, just that little spot of, you know, people needing to be seen even when they're just going to, you know, buy some dishwashing liquid.
Absolutely. And I think we definitely underestimate how important it is that we just are connected to each other as humans, right? And how do we create spaces for that, whether it's through our parks, whether it's through community centers? Anchor institutions really do that for us. And as those start to leave the community, we're forced to find other ways to do that. And sometimes those ways don't materialize readily.
But we also have to just get back to those basics too, though. I mean, I now live in the house that I grew up in. And when my grandmother, before she had Alzheimer's and passed away, lived there, you know, our running joke was, if you need something from the grocery store when I'm on my way over to visit you, you need to give me notice, because the one grocery store that's not even open anymore was so nasty and dirty and smelly.
Yeah,
I'm lip reading the name of the store to you. That I was like, I refuse to buy you any groceries from there. Right?
And I know exactly what store you're talking about.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Right, you right. have lived anywhere near downtown Kansas City, Kansas. You know what store I'm talking
yes,
about.
Yes.
So that you know what is on the landscape for KCK grocery stores then.
Well, right now we have the grocery store on 18th I-70, the Sunfresh grocery store there, which is a great store. It's nestled in the middle of a Hispanic and Latinx community, so it primarily serves that demographic. And we also have stores that are further out in western Wyandotte County. But on the eastern side of the county, we are going to be having the Merck Cooperative, the Mercantile Cooperative, which is a store in Lawrence, been there for probably 40 or 50 years. They're going to be opening a second location in downtown Kansas City, Kansas. It's a great concept for people to get to know what a cooperative model is, a consumer cooperative model, what that means in terms of ownership of the store, one voice, one vote. But there's still going to be some barriers there because that's going to be located on 5th and Minnesota, and there will still be food deserts that are further north in the community.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things about grocery stores is that, you know, it's hard to figure out where to go in terms of grocery stores. Like, for example, I know that if I want pork neck bones, I usually can't get that at the same store that I can get my salmon fillets,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you have a store that's opening up in KCK, you know, one of the first things I'm going to be checking out is, but what are the offerings?
Absolutely. And I will say that the Merck has done a pretty good job at reaching out to the community in terms of what it is they should be stocking on their shelves to make sure that their products are culturally relevant as mm-hmm. well. But it's not going to be a huge big box retailer type of store. It's very much a community-based source. So unfortunately, they're not going to be able to probably offer everything where you'd be able to find your ham hocks and your neck bones right next to, you know, your pre-made salads and everything like that. So I think it's also important to have diversity. I, like you, I go several different places for my food supplies, mostly because of my dietary restrictions. But I think that they've done a pretty good job in terms of surveying the community and what they want. And it's a delicate balance in making sure that you're serving what the community wants and then also that you can, you know, meet that 1% profit margin that exists in,
right.
in retail grocery store spaces.
You know, what's interesting is I have found living in where I live in Northeast Kansas City, Kansas, and I see this as being the case in many other lower income neighborhoods in Kansas City, especially that tilt toward having more Black and brown people, is that there aren't any grocery stores, but there are a whole lot of Family Dollars and mm-hmm. Dollar Trees mm-hmm. and stores that are fine as a supplement
right.
to having grocery stores, but as the only place where people can buy some milk?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that one of the things I heard from your story was this that Leon's, they were closing the store, but the liquor store was going to stay open.
Right.
Right. And so you think about these, what resources we do have in the community, like you said, the dollar stores. And unfortunately, people are not able to have all their needs met. They're not necessarily being served with dignity at these locations. And also, these stores are extracting wealth from our community. Oftentimes, what they're selling is going to cost more to the members of the community than if they were to go somewhere else just because of where they're located. So that is why it is so important for us to be able to take control of our own food supply and look at ways to create food sovereignty, which brings me to a project we're working on. We're working on bringing a cooperative grocery store to Northeast KCK, lovingly called Northeast Grocers. We're looking at installing a store there at 17th and Quindaro.
I know that well.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. Yes, it used to be the old Wilson's Hardware. And before that,
yeah.
it actually was a grocery store operated by the United Nation of Islam.
Okay.
And so that's a project we've been working on for about the last 2 or 3 years and still have a way to go on it. But we hope that we will be able to provide kind of what people need at a fair rate and serve them with dignity and then also offer them the opportunity for ownership. Because that's a really important piece that I think a lot of people in our communities, low-wealth communities, Black and brown communities, are not really that familiar with is the idea of owning a piece of something and having control over it, right?
Exactly. So we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Rachel Jefferson, and joining us next is someone who will be contributing a national perspective to the conversation. More of KCUR Central Standard in just a minute. Don't go away. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, filling in for Gina Kaufman. We've been talking about grocery stores with Rachel Jefferson of the Historic Northeast Midtown Association in Wyandotte County, and we want to also hear from you. What are you looking for in your neighborhood grocery stores? What are your grocery shopping habits like, and have they changed? Let us know at 816-235-2888. Joining us in the conversation now is Joe Fossler, the features editor at the New Food Economy. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, Joe. So one of the points that came up when I was doing a story on a local grocery store closing, I don't know if you heard the earlier part of the show, is how the expectations of people have changed over the years. One of the expectations, for example, is prepared food being offered that they can either eat on the spot or take home to eat right away. What other expectations have you seen change over the years?
I think that's a huge one. I just wrote a profile about a supermarket architect, and he tells his clients, if you're not in the restaurant business, you know, you're going to be out of business. And so having, you know, not even just prepare foods and takeaway foods, but actual cafes often, and even, you know, in-store restaurants, eating areas, is an increasing expectation. I think that people also, they kind of want to see the whole range. So they want to be able to buy, you know, more budget options, but they want to be able to spend a little bit on items that they really care about, whether that's a specialty, you know, cut of meat, or, you know, just some other sort of local product. They want to be able to see those kinds of special offerings alongside the, you know, more traditional commodity products.
So, you know, one store that comes to my mind that isn't in Kansas City, it's called Wegmans, and it's in D.C. Sure. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, and they're from New York State, you know, where I've lived most of my life. So, absolutely.
So, when I've visited a couple of times, a friend of mine, I can't even believe Wegmans. I mean, it just has like everything, like every kind of food, every kind of attached restaurant, every deli item. If you're trying to stay away from sugar, it's ridiculous, the bakery. And every time I go, I'm both simultaneously like enamored and ticked off that there's not something like that is in like every neighborhood in America. Why is that? Why is it that some stores, some communities can have that kind of store and some have nothing?
Yeah. So you're right to mention Wegmans. And I think Wegmans deserves a lot of credit for pioneering that model. In the 1990s, when grocery stores tended to have, you know, fewer prepared foods and kind of were, you know, a bit more homogenous in terms of their offerings, Wegmans was one of the first to really double down on that. You know, let's have an elaborate in-store bakery. Let's offer, you know, go beyond the deli case and actually have a sort of commissary kitchen where we're cooking stuff that people can take home by the pound. And it's been an enormously successful model for them. They're just about to open their first store in New York City in Brooklyn. It's hugely coveted real estate, and they've done exceptionally well. But you're right that kind of store is not available everywhere. And I think there's a few different reasons for that. You know, one, of course, is simple economics. It takes space. It takes money. It takes staff to have a store that operates that way. And unfortunately, that is something that is not always possible in all neighborhoods of the U.S. But I think it's for another reason, too, and that's that the culture of grocery stores is changing. For a long time, it wasn't the expectation that a grocery store could or should have those things. Mm. And the industry had done business a certain way for decades, and it didn't really see a reason to change that. now, with all of these emerging technologies and new approaches to food retail, that's changing very, very quickly. And stores that were quite comfortable for a long time are suddenly starting to find themselves facing some very difficult decisions.
Yeah, and that's what the owners of Leon's here in town said. And it reminds me of what Rachel was just saying. Because Rachel, have you ever been to Wegmans?
I have not.
Oh, it's worth a trip. But it reminds me of what you were saying, because I think of that a little bit when I go to the Whole Foods here in Kansas City and Brookside area, where it's both sort of the Wegmans approach of having everything on the spot down to having tables even where you can eat. But then it's a throwback to what you were talking about, Rachel, where it was a community spot where you bumped into people, where you see people, where there's an opportunity to find out information just because it's more than a grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that is what seems to be one of the challenges, I would think, for grocers. Does either one of you want to speak to how a poor neighborhood can meet that need?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's a matter of you have to make some tough decisions, right? One of the things that Joe was saying is interesting is the space. Just having a space big enough to serve that need, where you can have a cafe, you can have a full service grocery store, you could have restaurants attached. I don't know if that is completely practical. I think that we could do aspects of that. There was a group at one point that was looking at kind of like a corner store deli model. So the store that we're looking at is probably at most 15,000 square feet. Right. So we're obviously not going to be able to have all of the different types of things that a Wegmans would have. But maybe we can make some modifications to what we're serving and how we serve it that might give you that same sense of ambiance, that same sense of shared atmosphere. And I can come in for lunch and I can also pick up some groceries and go home. I think, again, you know, not to just kind of harp on this, but for low wealth communities, it has to be a community owned model. We cannot continue to wait for the free market to provide us what we need. And that goes for our food supply. That goes for all other different types of industry and commodities. We are going to have to build it ourselves. We're going to have to pull our resources. And we've done it before. Communities of color have a very strong history of cooperative economics. That's how we made it through the antebellum and Civil War periods. And so I think that it's just a matter of re-educating ourselves about how we did that before and how if we pull our resources together and get out of a scarcity mentality into more of a sharing mentality, we can do it.
Well, and that raises a great point about what makes this discussion about grocery stores so difficult, because I do think that it is a huge socioeconomic, you know, one could, you know, want to add a little spice to the mix, color controversy, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you live a life sort of like we talked about air conditioning yesterday, you know, and talking about, you know, heat islands. Mm. If you live a life where you can work someplace, get in a car, stop at a variety of grocery stores on the way to your home, and can even wait till you almost get home and there'll be a grocery store, that's a whole different issue than the issue of whether there is a store at all.
Right.
Near
Absolutely.
You know, Absolutely. So it's the basics versus luxury. But Joe, don't you think that the trend is sort of a blend of both?
I do. And I think that's one reason why some grocers are struggling, because I think I agree with everything that was just said about why there are challenges. But one thing we haven't mentioned is there's sort of a skills gap as well. And this is happening throughout the industry. Grocers have always been supply chain people. Essentially, their main skill is in buying goods in bulk, you know, and getting a good price for them and selling them for a little bit more. And that's been the job. The job now is different. It is about convening people. It's about serving them food, preparing food. These skills that traditionally grocers didn't necessarily have to use. And so there may be opportunities for collaboration, as was mentioned, whether it's, you know, bringing food trucks into the parking lot and sort of delegating some of those responsibilities to people who are already doing that in the community. Every store is going to have to find its own solution, but increasingly they're asked to have a much more robust skill set than was typically needed.
You know, that reminds me of something that I learned yesterday in the meeting to prepare for the show today, that Walmart now has grocery home delivery.
Wow.
Now,
not surprised.
I personally think that could be a whole show because my first thought was, really?
Yeah.
Because apparently the whole thing is you leave your key and you order your food and people from Walmart, I think I understood that correctly, and people put the food in your refrigerator and freezer.
Oh.
And I'm like, I don't want family coming into my house and stocking my kitchen. I mean, is that a wave of the future? I know Amazon delivers groceries now. What do you think about that, Joe?
Yeah, I have, absolutely. And believe me, that the people who advise grocery stores generally are saying, yeah, you need to have a delivery option. You need to invest in this infrastructure, which is really complicated and expensive. And that's why it was so interesting to write the profile of Kevin Kelly, who's an architect at the firm, LA-based firm Shook Kelly, who's really advising grocery stores to take a bit of a different approach. And his kind of idea is that, you know, there's certain things that are probably going to go online or that are going to be delivered. If it's paper towels, if it's dishwasher detergent, you know, it might just be easier to order that from Amazon or have it home delivered by Walmart or whoever can really do that. But there's certain things where you kind of don't want that experience. You know, do you really want to order tomatoes online? Do you want to just have them show up from Walmart? Do you want, you know, your cuts of meat that way? There are certain foods that, you know, we want that experience, that sensory experience of getting to touch them and select them and maybe sample them. And so in Kevin Kelly's view, you know, grocery stores, rather than try to outcompete, you know, the tech giants like Amazon and the retail giants like Walmart, might be advised to instead double down on what's going to bring people in the store. What's the thing that Amazon can't do? You know, how can they find ways to get communities to convene over the sensory pleasure of freshly prepared food, you know, or great ingredients? And that may be a place, rather than reinvent their whole model, try to compete with Amazon in that way, where they really might have some success.
And I think it would also disturbs me personally a little bit about the concept of us moving further and further into a home delivery model is that it makes the have-nots even more left in the cold when it comes to getting their delivery. I mean, I can't see a whole segment of our community, especially my neighbors, going to the technological trouble, let alone the mentality of somebody coming into your house, of somebody coming to your house to deliver food, right? And I mean, even going to the grocery stores. I mean, Rachel, have you seen that you're like me? We've talked about how we both go to a lot of different stores and a lot of different communities to get what we need, right? And have you noticed how the whole experience is different from store to store?
Yes, absolutely. It's a very different experience depending upon which store you're going into. It's a very different experience in terms of who's serving you. Is it, you know, are the people there culturally relevant? You know, can you ask them questions about products and they'll know the answer to them or be able to point you in that direction? So, yeah, I think that, you know, for me, it's also becoming a bit a class issue, right? Like you were saying. And so how are we ensuring that we are not continuing to widen that gap that exists between, like you said, the haves and haves not, the have and have nots? And I think about the digital divide that exists and just the different ways that we as an organization communicate with our residents. It has to be through robocalls and newsletters and yes, there's email and then there's social media and just how we've had to really change and modify our outreach networks to make sure that we're touching as many people as we possibly can. I'm not sure that, like you, I just am not completely bought into this idea that people are going to see that as more accessible, let alone letting someone else into your house to get up in your refrigerator. I don't think so. So I think it's really interesting what Joe was saying about doubling down on how to get people into the store instead of trying to change your whole model to kind of fit this fast-paced, you know, changing lifestyle that we live.
I mean, I think so much of even grocery store shopping is can sometimes feel like almost a mini spa experience compared to going to a store where there are literally nothing but the basics, right? Mm-hmm. So you go into a Whole Foods or a super nice Price Chopper in the right neighborhood, and you literally see flowers mm-hmm. when you walk in. I mean, think about the difference between seeing flowers when you walk into a grocery store and seeing now-laters in a barrel.
Right. Aesthetically, there are some big differences, like you were saying, in terms of the different stores that you shop at and how that makes you feel as a consumer. What does that mean towards your own, like your own sense of value and worth as a shopper, and how much your dollar is worth as opposed to if you're going to a Family Dollar or something like that, and things are kind of messy, and it doesn't look like there's any type of organized system, and you're kind of just having to be out on your own in the wild, so to speak, instead of like a really nice structured Whole Foods type of experience. I think that's something that, you know, we should be looking at. How do we bring that, or how do we help people bring that to communities that typically are not seen as deserving of that type of experience?
Exactly. And so one last thing I wanted to talk about on this conversation is, what do you think is the impact on having grocery stores or not having grocery stores? I mean, one thing that comes to mind to me, and you two may have different thoughts, is the obesity level.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's several different impacts in communities when you don't have a grocery store. I think there are economic, social, and cultural impacts of not having an anchor institution, not having that dollar turn around in your community, seeing a decrease in density of housing because of that, seeing people move towards different areas where they do have those resources and opportunities. And then, like we've said before, those places for people to convene and gather and just kind of, you know, information share and network. I think there are so many different impacts. We haven't even quite fully wrapped our brains around all of them.
Right, exactly. What about you, Joni? Thoughts?
I agree with all that. And you know, I think another factor is if we're at a moment where it's impossible for locally owned, you know, regional grocery stores and grocery chains to survive, I think that that has disturbing implications from a sort of corporate consolidation standpoint. Food is really important. It's a market with steady demand because we all eat. And if that, you know, supply is controlled by only a handful of you know, major international companies, I think that has disturbing implications for communities because it means they have less choice. It means, you know, prices go up in monopolistic situations. And really, you know, part of the argument for having locally owned grocery store infrastructure in a community is that it makes it more responsive to the needs of the community, whether that's price, whether that's selection, whether that's treatment of employees. That's something that every community should have.
Well, thank you both for this great conversation. I mean, I think it's a really important conversation. I wish more people really thought about what it would be like to have no options or really bad options. Mm-hmm. So we're about to go to break, but what's going to be coming up shortly is I'm going to be sitting down and talking with a local artist about his new exhibit that involves hell. I get to say hell on public radio. So anyway, we'll be right back. So don't you go away. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, filling in today for Gina Kaufman. And before we go, we are going to talk with local Kansas City artist Ryan Wilkes. Hey, Ryan.
Hello, Michelle.
How you doing?
So good. Thanks for having me on.
Good, good, good. Full disclosure, again, I did not pick this topic. I just lucked out. Ryan and I know each other because we took an Artist Inc. class together. So shout out to all our Artist Inc. mm-hmm. grads and all of that. So we're talking with Ryan today because he has a new exhibit. It challenges the concept of religious doctrine, and it is called Hill. So it is inspired by the illuminated manuscripts and biblical imagery, and Wilkes explores his own spirituality with his work that asks viewers to look inward and confront the foundations of their own faith and belief. You got heavy with it, didn't you, Ryan?
Well, yeah. Who wrote that? I like that. That's a lot better than my artist statement at the show.
So, okay, in your own words, explain what your new exhibit is about.
There's a couple different things. One is exploring the Christian theology. I've really just become obsessed with why the power structure of Christianity is still harming people in the way that it is now, specifically, and we see it most recently with abortion and this national conversation about this. This has been a conversation that started with Lilith. The story of Lilith is that she is the first wife of Adam, who refused his sexual advances and was cursed by God for all eternity, birth 100 babies a day, and they will all die. Ooh. That was her punishment. And that is the birth of the religion itself that is controlling, you know, women's bodies now.
Wow.
And then also, I guess the second part to this show is me exploring what my own prayers sound like, what my own doctrine as a queer person sounds like, and what they look like through the aesthetics of an illuminated manuscript.
So how does this relay? You recently had an exhibit about wishes.
Yes.
How do those two exhibits sort of both reflect Ryan?
I think in the fascination of modes of prayer, I'm fascinated with how people pray and what it does. So I've studied, you know, the science of what happens in our brains when we pray. There's quite a lot of studies that have been conducted on it. It's very interesting if you ever want to Google it, people at home. But I guess the common thread is I really like the idea of making art that is made through prayer and made made available to other people to pray with in a way. And I don't even really like the word pray because this isn't a religious experience. It's a human spirit one.
But isn't that what makes what some of your work does complicate it? Because people look at religion through a very narrow paradigm. Like even the word prayer, for some people, means this very specific conversation with the one God, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the more generic prayer that, you know, what is it, thoughts and prayers whenever there's a tragedy?
Absolutely.
Right? Which I don't think is really people praying.
No.
But, and then there's the prayer, as I think I'm hearing you say it, which is almost an entree to self on how to be a more aware person living a physical experience in a spiritual world.
Well said. Well said.
And I did that with the coffee, not quite kicking in. But is that what your work's trying to do?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thing about the Wish Project that I did last summer was that 28,209 people came and wrote wishes and prayers at this public altar, and I read every single one of them. And so there was a common thread of what people were asking for, and essentially it boils down to lessening the pain of living. And I think that's a beautiful thing. I think there's power in that, and whether or not any of it's real doesn't matter because it impacts, you know, positively, I think. And you said something that I'd like to go back to. You said something along the lines of almost like a prescribed prayer. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get away from, because as a queer person, religion and prayer is not part of my life. It can't be. There's a severance there through the structure of the church. And I actually don't like the way that the prayer structure is set up, because it's all the same thing. It's like people are taught when they need to pray for certain things how to say it. That's my biggest problem is nobody really, let me restate this, because I want to get it right.
I know, because we're getting deep here.
We're getting deep.
Before lunchtime.
Mm-hmm. But I think there's value and power in structuring an ask and structuring it the way you need it answered instead of asking the way others do.
Okay, you got to expand on that. What do you mean by that?
Well, like the structure of prayer, you know, hallowed be thy name, you know, these kinds of things that are repeated, they lack personal involvement because they're recitings.
Ah, so you're talking about the dogma of religion that doesn't always make it personal for the individuals who are seeking out comfort or seeking out maybe even an actual ask?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And so a lot of these manuscripts that I've made, I've devised a font that from first glance looks like a foreign language. But when you get up close, it's actually each letter is alive. It's a character. And the prayers are my own prayers to self. And like what I, you know, for instance, one of them begins with, "Eye of a needle, thread open for me. Stitch me together with golden seams. Unfold my will before me when my will beckons me. By the power of 3x3, let this be." And so that's the kind of doctrine that I'm making, is it's devoid of religious phrasings.
That's prayer and poetry.
Prayer and poetry.
I love it.
You just started a new slam title.
So could you, since radio is, thank God for me, not a visual medium, could you describe to someone listening what, say, that piece of art you were just talking about? What does that look like?
Well, it is about 25 inches long. It's in a beautiful gold-gilded frame, and it's a giant uppercase E. And the uppercase E is molded to look like a cow. And inside that E are demons playing and killing each other, and then also the text. So just like the illuminated manuscript, there's stories with human form, and then there's also the text. And the text is, I think, some of my most beautiful work that I've ever made. It's more than just letters on a page. They're drawings.
So I was going to ask you, what medium do you use to do this? Paint, charcoal, pen, ink?
Well, the original illuminated manuscripts were made on infant cow vellum out of skin. And so I can't really get a hold of that right now, especially with my budget, because a lot of it comes from Europe. So I'm doing it on Bible pages from, I have a Bible I was gifted from 1777. And I'm gold leafing and painting with lapis lazuli on these old Bible pages. And much of the work is done on repurposed Bible pages.
Wow. So lapis lazuli, isn't that a mineral, a gem?
Yes.
So how do you paint with that?
Well, you know, fortunately, Daniel Smith is a wonderful paint maker, and their company makes just crushed pigments. So they even have like amethyst crystal pigments that you can paint with.
I love amethyst.
I know, it's beautiful.
Oh, wow. So, okay, have you had anybody in this? When did this current exhibit open?
Last Saturday.
And where is it?
It is at the Lidi Volkus Art Center.
So how so far has the reception been?
Well, the caliber of people, as far as like the peers that I respect most, and may not even know, actually, in some cases, people that I admire from afar, they all came. And the reviews, I've had people put their hands on my heart and like tell me that it's incredible. And Jim Leedy, the legend, said that it was an amazing show. So the reviews are really great. The public, it's interesting because on First Fridays, I got views of people that would walk in and gasp, and the expression on their face would mimic that of seeing roadkill. So it was really interesting to see the array of reactions, because you either get it or you don't. You either love it or no one is indifferent.
So do you find that there are some people who feel like it might be sacrilegious?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I spent years studying Satanism, so a lot of the imagery is the opposite of, it's blasphemy. Okay. It's a show of blasphemy. I mean, the title itself, Hell, it's blasphemy.
So I want to hear more from you, because I can only imagine how some people, I mean, we are in the Bible Belt.
You
know,
course.
On some days we are the buckle of the Bible Belt. So I can only imagine that there's a real like you said, like almost visceral reaction to your work. Is that what you're aiming for, I assume?
I'm aiming to have the conversations, because on First Friday, for example, I had a group of women who heard about the show come in and pray around me in a circle.
Oh.
And it actually opened up a really interesting conversation where I had the opportunity to explain to them that as a young, you know, queer person, my first introduction to shame and self-loathing and the devaluing of my existence was through religion. And it was through God, and it was through men telling me that I wasn't worthy, that my spirit, that my soul was not worthy. And like to internalize that, as so many people do, is a really harmful thing. And the truth is, a lot of human beings want to connect to some sort of like spiritual, we want to touch divinity. Yeah. We want to. And we've been doing it forever. And so the purpose of my work for me personally is to give myself the freedom to go ahead and touch that I can touch that, that I'm worthy of touching that. And I'm worthy of making it too. And I don't know. And that conversation that got to happen at First Fridays with these people was really a healing conversation. And we all hugged each other. Aww. We walked away disagreeing with each other, but we walked away with smiles and we were hugging. And it's kind of neat, too, because we have totally opposite theologies, and yet we shared kindness.
Well, it sounds like when they came down to the exhibit to do this, mm-hmm. that it sounds like, and this is me being very generous, and I'm basing my generosity on your depiction of what happened, uh-huh. right? That they were worried about you.
They were worried about me. They yeah. wanted to save me, and yeah. it's not an uncommon thing for a Christian to approach me in my life and offer to save my eternal soul through, you know. And I used to be very offended by it, but now I just kind of use it as an opportunity to just talk.
So what are other pieces in your exhibit, if you can describe them? Again, I know that you using words to describe your visual art is like me trying to paint one of my plays.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that we're talking about two different mediums, but as much as you can you think of another piece that people are very responsive to and describe it?
Sure. I think one of the most responsive pieces is a 9-foot painting of a giant penis.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we can say that on the air.
Yeah, I think so. It's just a body part.
You just can't really say in the pejorative what you would do with that.
Of course.
Right.
And I would never.
But
I'm a lady.
but so it's a 9-foot penis.
It sure is.
What's the medium that you use?
One shot enamel paint. It's stunning.
Okay. Okay. What color?
Bright yellow, white, and black were the only colors I used.
Okay.
And it's basically part of studying the Christian doctrine and everything and how the power structures are set up. It's all devised by men to benefit men. And the close-up of the phallus in this painting is of a man bending down.
Okay.
Forcibly submitting.
Okay, Ryan, I was about to say, be careful how we describe this from this point forward.
Course,
right,
yeah.
right, right. But that you did a very good job.
Thank you.
You did a very good job. So do people have a response and a reaction when they come and see that?
Absolutely. A lot of people took pictures in front of it. I mean, it's a quite beautiful piece, and it's very confrontational. This work on one side of the gallery is confrontational. On the other side, it's inviting. It's inviting you in to read these prayers. So one of the other sides on the confrontational side of the gallery is actually an abortion piece. Mm. It's Lilith, the curse of Lilith depiction of there's a hanging porcelain baby from a wire that I've made that I painted with enamel. It's a quite beautiful piece, but it definitely is confrontational. And in that, it's going to challenge people's, you know, ideas.
So just one last thing.
Yeah.
What is the takeaway that you want people to have with your work when they come see it, regardless of where their head is walking in the door? What's the name of the gallery again?
The Lady Vulcus Art Gallery.
Okay. What do you want them to walk out with?
One of my paintings.
Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Right.
I would.
No, you aren't. But besides one of your paintings.
I want them to walk out with new thoughts. I've had a lot of people reach out and share their new thoughts that this work has inspired in them, and I want people to have that.
That's awesome. Ryan Wilkes, thank you so much for being with us today. Earlier, we talked about the changing landscape of grocery stores. If you missed it or you want to share it with someone who wants to hear it, you can find all these conversations on our website a little later this afternoon, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we're talking tacos and enchiladas and tamales and chimichangas. We'll talk about it all with the food critics. I'm getting really kind of hungry just thinking about it. This show is produced by Melody Rawl, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, Salisa Kalakal, and intern Riley Lester. I'm Ian Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and Regina Kaufman of To Date is next.